Hey, cool. Well, I would cheers, but we have hot coffee.
That's okay.
So welcome to Talk Mental Health with Logan Noon, your second episode in 24 hours, which
Yes.
is pretty cool.
Becoming a podcast authority.
Yeah, no one's ever done that. So that's very, very cool. So thank you for coming
You're
on.
welcome.
We'll release the episodes, of course, not within 24 hours. But Dr. Aistreich, you are one of my or you were one of my physiology professors.
Correct.
One of my favorite professors. You really
Oh.
taught me well over the last couple of years. And why I wanted to do today's episode is we're going to be talking about anxiety and meditation today. And so I'm now a third-year medical student, about halfway through. So I've interacted with a decent amount of patients, not a ton. And I, of course, love the mental health cases. I would get super stoked on those. And one problem that I ran into is I would meet, and this mostly happened with older patients. I would talk to older patients and they'd be like, "Yeah, I'm anxious, I'm having panic attacks, I'm not sleeping." And instead of talking about drugs right away, I would always talk about exercise and meditation. And whenever I started talking about meditation, I could just see the
The
look in
eyes
their
can
eyes.
glaze over.
Yeah, they'd be like, "Dude, this damn hippie, this frickin' like
They
guy,
got a
he probably has
joint
his
in his
like
pocket,
yeah, and
and
his like yoga mats all in his car and like yeah, just it. So I really struggled, and I would try to explain the power of meditation, but they clearly just would tune off as soon as I would talk about it. So I want to, have this episode serve as like, hey, this is talking to a top-of-the-line PhD physiologist who really understands the complexity of all this and can explain it to patients much better than I can. So that's why I want to have you on today.
Okay.
Thanks again for coming
It's a tall
on.
order. I will do my best.
No,
Yes.
you're going to do fantastic. Well, I guess before we even get into the nit and gritty, you can talk about this subject much better, I think, than I can. Anxiety is like the most common disorder or mental health disorder in America.
Yep.
I have some stats here. Let me pull them out.
Do share.
So panic disorder, where people have recurrent panic attacks. In America, this was a 2005 study. They estimated it's between 2.7 and 4.7% of the population. I
Interesting.
always think this is grossly underrepresentative, and I feel
Yes.
like people don't actually
I
report these
think all
things.
mental health conditions are grossly underreported, probably.
Yes.
Yes.
But a third of all Americans will experience some version of panic attacks throughout their lifetime. And about 37% of people who experience panic attacks also have depression at some point in their lives. So you've experienced some panic attacks.
I
So can you
have.
tell us about those?
Sure. Yeah. So my earliest memory of a panic attack actually happened in the happiest place on earth, Disney World
Oh,
in
wow.
Orlando, Florida, and I think I was 8 or 9 years old.
Oh,
And
whoa.
we had, yeah, it was kind of a crazy experience. So we'd been there all day, and I had a good time. I was with my family and got to see Goofy and went on all the rides. And then when you go to Disney World, you park kind of in a car park, and then you take a ferry across this body of water, and then you get off in Main Street USA or whatever, and you go into Disney World. So at the end of the day, as you can imagine, everyone's trying to leave Disney World at the same time. And so there's just this huge horde of people waiting for the ferry to go back to the car park so that you could leave. And I had been getting, I didn't know, I mean, I was 8 years old, I didn't quite understand what was happening to me, but I had been feeling increasingly yuckier kind of as the day went on. And then we were just standing there in this crowd of people, and I was sweating. I was in Florida, but I was sweating more than I would have expected. I remember my heart really pounding, and I couldn't hear anything. And then I just kind of burst into tears, and I felt like I was suffocating. And I was trying to tell my mom what was going on, and all I could really get out was, "Don't let anyone else touch me." So it was just this feeling that this crowd of people was basically going to suffocate me to death while we were waiting for the ferry to get back to the car park. And so my parents tried to create, like a little zone around me so they could calm me down. And but that probably lasted about 10 minutes as I recall. So it was pretty terrifying experience. And then I would kind of off and on have issues with crowds throughout my adolescence and early adulthood. But sort of the other one that really stands out to me, it was kind of a bonding experience between my then boyfriend and now husband. We had gone to the Rochester Farmers Market. So this was when I was in grad school. Okay. I was an adult by this time, and mm-hmm. you know, kind of theoretically had control over my actions and emotions. Mm-hmm. And we went to the Rochester Farmers Market, which can get pretty busy, and this okay. was a weekend. And there's one building that kind of goes along the back of the market that had vendors in stalls on kind of either side of this corridor. And I remember we got maybe halfway through it, and I started to feel kind of some of those familiar feelings of just suffocation and too many people around and people touching me and just feeling bumped and crowded. Okay. And I told him, I was like, I have to get out of here.
Oh, wow.
That was the first, I just remember telling him that, and he was like, what is wrong? And he could tell I was getting very red and I was sweating, and I told him my heart was pounding. I told him I couldn't breathe, and he could tell I couldn't breathe. And then again, you know, probably like another quarter of the way down the hall, I was just crying, sobbing okay. because I needed to get out of the, out of the hallway.
So for you, it's only been crowds that have stimulated
mostly,
this?
It's mostly crowds. Yeah. Okay. And then there is a sense. So I think probably in some of the reading that we've both done leading up to this, I found it kind of interesting that in DSM-4, they used to kind of lump agoraphobia mm-hmm. and panic disorder mm-hmm. together. They've been separated in DSM-5, but I totally get that because some of the things that they talked about were the reasons that people develop agoraphobia is because they're trying to avoid a situation in which they experience public panic. Mm. And I know that I've definitely done that.
Yeah.
So there's times when I haven't gone to an activity or, you know, concerts or things like that, and I've been like, I don't think I can do that. And so, you know, I think there's a little bit of agoraphobia, but not an extreme case or anything like that, but there's certainly a tendency to avoid crowds and engage in other behaviors that help me sort of deal with what I know could be a potentially panic situation. So
yeah.
I will never sit in a window seat on an
airplane,
for example.
Okay.
I don't like kind of being stuck in a place that
like
I can't get out of. Exactly. Yeah, the subway is really hard for me. Mm. Oh my gosh, we went to visit my husband's family at Christmas maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and had to fly through JFK mm-hmm. To get to Albany. So we had to rent a car, and in order to rent a car, you have to get on this train that goes from the terminal to the rental car places. And
Don't worry, I'm very familiar.
You're familiar.
With how much
okay.
JFK sucks.
It's horrible. JFK is the pit of hell. Don't ever fly through JFK if you could avoid it. And people are so fucking mean. I mean, they're just like horrible.
Well, that's New England. I mean,
I know.
That's just normal.
I know. Yeah. I lived in New York for 6 years, so okay. I was kind of prepared for it, but I'd been away for a while, and we were just trying to figure out how to get to the train to get to the car park place, and no one would even like give us a straight answer. It was like they were intentionally sending us the wrong way. And I was
probably.
New Yorkers
probably.
Suck. I remember this now.
Yeah. Well, so I guess before we talk about how you dealt with that agoraphobia, and you know, meditation and all those techniques, I guess let's hone in on like, so when you experience panic attacks, the agoraphobia, or what, you know, whenever someone experiences panic attacks, let's then get into like the nitty and gritty. What is going on inside of their body that's making them feel that flush feeling, that that heart rate that goes through the roof, that I'm gonna die, I can't breathe kind of feeling?
Yeah, so the physiological part of it, the manifestations that you feel in the body are really all coming from kind of two pathways. So you have a discharge of the sympathetic nervous system, so that's often called our fight or flight component of our nervous system. And then you have a discharge of neurons to the adrenal gland, which cause a bunch of release of cortisol into your circulation. So you have a spike in adrenaline, as you'll often hear it called, or epinephrine, release of a whole bunch of norepinephrine from a bunch of nerve terminals, and then a big increase in cortisol in the blood. Mm-hmm. And so cortisol, epinephrine, or adrenaline, and norepinephrine are all considered to be quote-unquote stress hormones. Mm-hmm. And so essentially what they're doing is preparing your body to fight or flight.
Yeah.
So the flushing, the sweating is all a sympathetic effect on your sweat glands, the booming heart, So the increase in your heart rate and this feeling that it's going to beat out of your chest, that's all coming from sympathetic stimulation of the heart. Mm-hmm. Your lungs are going to dilate. All those airways are going to dilate so that you can bring more air into your body. Emotionally, you feel just this sense of aggression, I guess you could say, a need to fight or escape. And then the cortisol itself, the effect is a little bit harder for you to feel in the moment, but one of the big things it's doing is causing mobilization of glucose, which gives you kind of an energy boost to make your fight or flight decision there. So
yeah. And well, one thing I think that's so interesting about anxiety and panic attacks is like the root of all this evolutionarily. Like, anxiety isn't bad.
It's
like,
not bad.
Yeah, it's like, it's how humans evolved, like when we saw a tiger or something chasing us.
Exactly, yeah.
And one of the articles you sent me gave me a great analogy. It's like when you're in crossing the street and you see a car coming at you, that response, that fight or flight, like, that's a good thing. You want it there.
Exactly.
And so it's just sort of weird, like, this evolutionary trait has almost gotten out of control in humans these days. Maybe because we're in more safe environments or whatever, but it's just kind of gotten out of control.
Yeah, it's essentially a misfiring and a magnified misfiring of something that is evolutionarily designed to protect you. Yeah, that's a really good way to put it. Because you are, when you have a panic attack, you are essentially trying to protect yourself in a way. You're trying to escape from whatever caused that sensation of panic in you. But it's definitely not a stimulus that you would normally expect to induce panic in someone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I remember I interviewed a classmate, and it was actually one of the most downloaded podcasts. It was the most downloaded episode I've ever had. It was about panic attacks. Mm-hmm. And she said one of her big overcomings was, you know, I know that I can't die from a panic attack kind of thing, which I think is like mostly true. I imagine if someone has like a cardiovascular issue, maybe they could succumb.
Potentially, yeah. If they had some kind of comorbid problem that their heart rate goes up, their oxygen utilization goes up, and they're not getting enough blood to their cardiac tissue, there could be a fatal event there. But yes, for most of us, not a problem. Yeah.
So what though makes, you know, going back to if a tiger's chasing us, we want that fight or flight.
Yep.
But why now are people having that fight or flight, like you, when you're in Disney World, where it's relatively a safe environment, of course, and or people have panic attacks like in school here when there's like a test, and of course that's scary, but you're not going to die from a test kind of thing.
Right. Yeah.
So why have we evolved to use that system in not a productive way?
Yeah, I don't think we necessarily evolved, but I think that as the human cortex got more and more complex, the interactions that the cortex, so the human cortex of the brain is just a magnificent thing. Mm-hmm. It's what allows us critical thinking skills. It's what allows us to plan complex patterns of movement. It's what allows us to do everything basically that makes us human and sort of distinguishes us more from animals. But with all of that complexity comes a whole bunch of opportunities for goof-ups, basically. And so nobody really knows why these things trigger panic attacks in some people, stimuli that shouldn't be panic-inducing. But there is a growing field of research that suggests it's essentially an inappropriate, strong connection between certain regions of the cortex and regions of the brain that are more primitive, like the amygdala, which is essentially kind of the fear center of the brain. Mm-hmm. So for whatever reason, in some people, these sensory stimuli, these things that trigger off panic attacks, are causing the cortex to basically tell the amygdala to go nuts.
Yeah.
And the exact circuitry that's involved there, it hasn't been entirely worked out, but that's basically what's happening.
Well, and I think with mental illness, so many people try to, it's almost like, oh, it's my fault that I have panic attacks. It's my fault that I feel depressed kind of thing. But it's like, well, maybe, but it's more the wiring, I would say, of your brain. And some of that is genetics. Like, I don't know if panic attacks ran in your family at all or...
You know, I don't know. I don't know if crowd anxiety did or panic attacks. They certainly do in my husband's family.
Okay.
And so his mother has... Very even when she's doing getting ready to do something that would be considered fun, like go on a cruise, we dropped them off to go on a cruise to Alaska, and she was just a mess. She was clearly having a panic attack, and my husband has a lot of anxiety, his sister has a lot of anxiety, so around different kinds of issues. I think my husband's is more centered on sort of being a hypochondriac and and always feeling as though he has a disease that's about to kill him or something like that. His sister's issues are a little bit different, but there's definitely a thread of anxiety running through the family. And so they've actually done studies on twins to try and get at some of that genetic association and whether or not anxiety issues do run in families. And it's absolutely, there's shown to be things that can't be explained by environment or individual experience, things that could really only be explained if there was a genetic correlation. So, and that certainly implies that something, whether it's neurotransmitters or brain structure itself, is involved in this. So that's completely out of the person's control.
Yeah. And one thing that I found super interesting in the articles that you sent me is how it talked about in this one study that how the amygdala and hypothalamus were hyperexcitable for people with panic.
Yes.
And so for the listeners who, you know, were saying these words, it's like, what the hell are we talking
about?
What is
all of this?
So I guess in my, you know, I'm a medical student, but I still have very limited understanding of this. My understanding is like the amygdala and hypothalamus are the most primitive centers of our brain kind of thing. You know, we had that even before we were really humans, quote unquote.
Right.
And, you know, the prefrontal cortex, the front part of your brain, is like the executive functioning portion of your brain. And so from my understanding of these, this panic attack, it's like the amygdala is firing off so much that it then goes to your prefrontal cortex and you act on it. You, like for you, you had to remove yourself from Disneyland or Disney World. And, or, you know, you stayed home from some of those concerts or something. I'm sure you would have liked to go to kind of thing. So can you explain, though, to the listener who doesn't really, I guess, understand the brain so much, like what we're talking about, the primitive portion of your brain versus the more evolutionary, like, cortex part of
your brain? Sure, yeah. So the primitive parts of our brain are there. So partly the hypothalamus and a little bit lower in the brainstem play a huge role in regulating our homeostasis, which is a fancy word that essentially means our body's kind of normal functioning. So the hypothalamus and the brainstem make sure that our heart rate is set at a reasonable level, and it makes sure that we can maintain our blood pressure, and it makes sure that we essentially urinate at the right time and that we maintain the right blood volume and salt level and those kinds of things. So just the things that basically keep our body going on a day-to-day basis, those are called our autonomic functions, or the things that are outside of our conscious control, that we just do without even thinking about it, like breathing. So our breathing rate is another thing that's controlled in our brainstem. When it comes to the cortex, that's more, in the limbic system particularly, that's more when emotion gets involved. The cortex, as you mentioned, the prefrontal cortex is our executive function center, so that helps us make behavioral decisions based not only on sensory input, but also emotional input, and so there's higher order functioning stuff happening there. Whereas the amygdala, being a very primitive part of the brain, is essentially just there to communicate feelings of fear, anxiety, need to escape a bad situation, essentially. And the reason that we're not doing that all of the time, the reason that we're not so reactionary to things that our ancestors might have been, like seeing a snake on the ground or something like that, is because we have those higher order brain centers in our cortex that tamp things down. And so when everything's working normally, our amygdala does what it's supposed to do, which is that it warns us like it's supposed to do. But when those things aren't working appropriately, that's when things tend to get out of whack. And so the problem there is that a lot of that circuitry that's coming from the cortex routes not only through the amygdala, but also through the hypothalamus and the brainstem. So when you get these big discharges from the amygdala, you get all of that stuff that comes along with potent activation of the sympathetic nervous system in the brainstem and activation of release of cortisol and all that lower function stuff.
So I now have a kind of a series of questions in my head. So I guess first off, before we talk about like how to turn off the sympathetic system and essentially relax, what happens, you know, we all know people in our life that are very, very anxious, like all of the time. People with panic disorders have them a lot. So what happens to bodies over time when they're constantly exposed to too much sympathetic activation, too much adrenaline and panic.
Yeah, nothing good, really.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of a cardiovascular physiologist by training, so I'll sort of start there. When you have a high level of sympathetic output all of the time, that causes a number of problems. First, these individuals will tend to be hypertensive, which means that their blood pressure is higher than normal. Mm-hmm. They have higher resting heart rates and strength of contraction, which means that their heart is working harder than a person that doesn't have panic disorder. Mm-hmm. And that's okay when you're young and you have plenty of heartbeats left. But as you start to age, you don't want your heart kind of working any harder than it needs to, because at the end of the day, it is a mechanical pump, and pumps wear out.
Yeah.
And so they're at greater risk for developing heart failure at some point during the course of their lifetime. The cortisol is particularly problematic because it can put you at greater risk for developing metabolic syndromes, because you have this higher than normal blood glucose all the time. Mm-hmm. It can actually interact with the immune system and create a pro-inflammatory environment in the body, and that pro-inflammatory environment can cause all sorts of tissue dysfunction and damage at the level of multiple organs, and so that can also be not so good.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, you think about the sympathetic nervous system being your fight or flight system, whereas the parasympathetic system is sort of your rest and digest system, and so your balance is kind of always tipped towards fight or flight, and so that can impact emotion. So you're more on edge, you're more easily excitable, you are going to have a harder time making rational decisions when you're in this high cortisol, high adrenaline environment. You're going to have trouble sleeping.
Yeah.
And so all of the stuff that can come along with poor sleep quality, you kind of add in on top of that.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up. One of the articles you sent me talked about how they think there might be a correlation, and they don't, maybe it's a cause, but they don't know, between sleep apnea and panic disorder.
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah, I mean, who knows? And maybe that's just like a confounding circle. They can't sleep, and then they're sleeping bad. And
yeah, there's a lot of correlations between breathing disorders in general and panic disorders. Mm. And I think that that's because breathing is something that we don't usually think about unless it's not happening properly, right? So you can imagine that when kids start to have asthma attacks, that might induce feelings of panic, because they're it's almost the situation in reverse. So you can't breathe, you panic, and that actually makes the situation worse.
Yeah,
and so that's true in patients with COPD, with asthma, emphysema. A lot of those individuals eventually go on to develop some kind of panic disorder.
So,
sleep apnea might be a similar thing.
And one of the papers that you sent me, it theorize that people with higher issues of anxiety have higher heart rates and respiratory rates, just like chronically over time.
Yep.
And that makes total sense.
Yeah.
So I guess let's now talk about then the other side. Like, how do you get your sympathetic system to stop and relax?
Right. Yeah. So that depends a little bit on the individual and what they're willing to do. So the traditional kind of approach to individuals with panic disorder has been a combination of psychotherapy and pharmacology.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people will be put on SSRI, so selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which increase the amount of serotonin in your brain. That's a common treatment for antidepressants, but also, for reasons that are not entirely clear, has efficacy in panic disorder.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people, depending on their tendency to develop substance use problems, will be put on benzodiazepines, although you kind of have those are sort of downers. That would be the lay way to put it, or sedatives. And those don't necessarily target the specific areas of the brain that are overreacting during panic. They're targeting the entire brain.
Mm-hmm.
So there's basically tamping the brain's activity down a little bit. And so when you do that, you inevitably hit the places that are overactive during panic. The problem with those kinds of things is that they come along with a lot of side effects that can really impact the quality of life of the patient. So even though their panic is better managed, now they're dealing with all of the side effects of the medications that are not so pleasant, like feeling doped up all the time. And
even those medications don't work 100% of the time.
No, yeah, and it can take a tremendous amount of time to get the dose right, and if ever, and to get an onset of effect. So the person's waiting 12 weeks for the medication to actually kick in, and in the meantime, they're getting frustrated, and they just stop taking it, which is totally understandable.
And then from my understanding, it seems like, and don't ask me the physiology of this, please, but like epinephrine, the adrenaline, can be broken down by the body, and that's one way that we can kind of get back to that resting, relaxed state. Or you can induce the parasympathetic system to get going.
Yes.
And I think that's kind of a good segue for us to start talking about meditation.
Sure. Yeah.
So can you quickly explain, when we say parasympathetic, like what in the hell are we talking about?
So we were talking about the sympathetic division being fight or flight. Parasympathetic is rest and digest. So it's basically the thing that calms you down. It lowers your heart rate. It stimulates your GI functions when you've just had a meal. That's kind of the digest part. It makes you feel calm and relaxed, and so it's kind of the opposite of the sympathetic division in many ways. Does that answer your question?
I think it does. Okay. And you know, if for the scientifically inclined listener, it's like we're trying to stimulate more acetylcholine to be released in our body, where is, like we keep saying, adrenaline or epinephrine is our fight or flight. Acetylcholine is kind of our relaxation hormone, quote unquote, I guess.
Kind of, yeah. And it's sort of more at the tissue level that you want to think about it. So acetylcholine stimulates the GI tract, right? But that's actually a rest and digest function. So it's not that it's always inhibitory, but it does tend to put us in a state of... It's like our basal state. So we're not up and ready to fight. We're not up and ready to flight. We're ready to sit down and chill and digest and watch Netflix and do all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
So, you know, with meditation, it seems like it's been in the news so much. So many people hear about all these health benefits. And in all those, the research that you gave me to read over, it seems like we still don't exactly understand how it works. We kind of understand the results.
Right.
Or we can measure the results.
Yeah, that's true of a lot of drugs, too.
Yeah.
So don't let the pharmaceutical industry fool you on that one.
Yeah. Just a couple things about meditation that I thought was interesting. Like, I've lived in other countries, but only for 1 year. And, like, the United States, in one study, one out of every 13 people have practiced meditation regularly in the last year. But, like, in Australia, one out of six people practice meditation. So it seems like around the world, and people are more willing to use meditation.
Yep.
And in America, we're very, very resistant.
It's
very frustrating considering how bad we are with our health outcomes. So I guess some of the things that... I learned, I guess I knew some of these things, but I learned, you know, the eight areas that consistently seem to improve in meditation is meta-awareness, body awareness, self and emotion regulation, and lower perceived stress and anger. And so when, you know, meditation is so nebulous, and in those papers that you sent me, I remember there was like this one page with 20 different versions of meditation. And I don't even really like to get into the nitty-gritty of the different types. I don't think it's worthwhile. I just think if people can dedicate time in their day to just being in the present moment, that counts. And so what do you say, though, and I've gotten this quite a bit, I talk about meditation all the time, and people come back and say, well, I can't meditate because I can't think about nothing.
Yeah, I think that it's a misconception about what meditation actually is, and probably a little bit of fear or prejudice in even thinking about the word meditation. People have a connotation that it's something that hippies do.
Yeah.
Or that's an Eastern thing. You know, that's something that you'll hear from some people, or that's all just garbage. It's not going to work for me. I think it is a misconception that you're supposed to completely empty your mind of all thoughts. And in some forms of meditation, maybe that's true. But there's so many different ways that you can meditate. And it doesn't even have to be a thing where you just sit still and be quiet. So there are plenty of yoga practices, for example, that involve a meditation component while you're moving and while you're working your muscles really
hard.
There's
walking meditation.
There's walking meditation, which I thought was really cool. And there's focused attention meditation, where you're not emptying your mind at all. You're just focusing on an object or a phrase or a saying or something that you're kind of pouring all of your attention into. And so I think when you characterize things under a blanket term like meditation, that tends to make it easier to dismiss than thinking about, well, hey, you know, what's something that might work for you? And I think that that's part of why we've seen the word meditation fall out of favor a little bit in the United States, and you hear the term mindfulness so much more now, because that implies an action, and I think that Americans are hardwired to do something all the time.
Yes.
Yeah, we just don't, we don't take vacations. We work more than any other developed country in the world, and we don't meditate, right? But we can be mindful. That's something that, that we can do, and so I think that it's starting to get a little bit more traction thinking about it that way.
Yeah. I looked up the exact definitions,
because
I was like, well, I've always talked about this, but maybe I don't know. So the definition, at least in the articles I looked at, meditation is trying to improve your concentration, your awareness, and familiarize yourself with your own mind. So that sounds, you know, kind of woo-woo, whatever.
Yeah.
But mindfulness is defined as paying attention in a particular way in the present moment while being non-judgmental.
Yeah.
So it kind of makes sense. So there's, I mean, I always say people, if they want to start meditating, YouTube is the easiest way to start.
Yeah.
You can just, so, you know, either way, you're a PhD in physiology. So we don't know, of course, exactly what happens and why it happens with meditation, but what are some of the results of our body after meditating regularly for 4 weeks or whatever?
I think the most impressive things have actually come from functional MRI studies on people's brains that are experienced meditators. So these are people that have accumulated hundreds of hours meditating.
And functional MRIs is where you can see like how much blood flow is going to each region.
Yeah, it's basically
brain.
It kind of lights up different areas of your brain that are active during a particular activity. So you don't have to be laying still for functional MRI. They can actually do the analysis while you're engaging in a particular activity, like playing a video game or meditating or something like that. And so one of the really cool things that's been found in these people that are regular meditators is that their amygdalas are actually smaller.
Yes.
Their overreacting fear center shrinks, and areas of the brain that are more involved in executive function and emotional control and stress responses and control, like the prefrontal cortex, are actually more highly developed and more active in those individuals. And so this is hard structural evidence that basically says that the brains of people that meditate are better engineered to deal with stressful situations and things that might induce panic as compared to those that don't.
Yeah.
And so I think that's pretty powerful. It's basically, this is your brain on meditation and this is your brain on stress and, you know, kind of toxic stimuli.
And we've been talking just kind of about panic and fear with the amygdala, but also in those articles you sent me, it talked a lot about how pain can even be reduced with meditation. And it seemed almost like, from my understanding, like being able to separate your thoughts and your actions from what you perceive emotionally, whether that be fearful or just an emotion of pain.
Yeah, the amazing thing about that is that the areas of the brain that sort of communicate the unpleasantness of pain to other parts of the brain, those are actually very active and very highly developed in individuals who meditate. But it seems that the circuits that communicate that unpleasant experience to other parts of the brain get rewired, so that basically says, hey, this isn't that bad.
Yeah.
You know, you can deal with this, you can handle this, as opposed to the person that, that doesn't meditate has a more unpleasant perception of what pain actually is, which I think is pretty incredible. So
in those studies that I was reading, it kind of went over many different metrics of how we're measuring health, but seemed to be the most widely accepted is lower cortisol levels and lower heart rates from meditating. And so, I mean, do you have any theories of why that is, or
yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with those centers of the brain, like the insular cortex and like the amygdala, that tend to bombard the brainstem during a panic situation, and they say, ooh, up the sympathetic nervous system. And they say, ooh, hypothalamus, tell the adrenal cortex to release cortisol. So in someone who's meditating and you don't have as highly a developed an amygdala, or you don't have that strength of connection coming from, so there's higher order centers that are telling that thing to fire, it shuts all that down. So you're basically starting the, or kind of stopping the problem at the starting gate. So you're shutting down that sympathetic output, that fight or flight response that you get during panic. You're lowering the levels of cortisol because now the brainstem isn't telling the adrenal cortex to actually release it anymore. So you're not getting those unpleasant effects of those downstream signals like adrenaline and cortisol because you're not releasing as much anymore.
Okay. Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. And one theory that I thought, where did I write it down here? It was, well, you know, we talked about it in this feeling of panic, like you can't breathe, that suffocation. And so if you practice in a meditation practice that's more focused on breathing, and that's what I like to do. I try to just focus on my breathing in and out, and I kind of say mantras with my breath. But that can actually train someone to breathe more fully and breathe slower versus if they're always amped up, you know, they're taking maybe short breaths, hyperventilating. And that made a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, that was hugely helpful to me. So that was one of the major things that I focused on after I realized that when I do start to feel these sensations of panic, the first thing that my brain says is, you're suffocating. I was like, well, I should learn to do things that force me to concentrate on breathing and maintaining a regular pattern of breathing. So when I do feel panic coming on, I went to a counselor that taught me to count. Basically, it's a pretty simple thing. They're like, you're just going to count slowly. And as you count, inhale. And as you move to the next count, exhale. And, you know, just get in the habit of starting. And it's a very simple meditation. It's not anything fancy. But it really helps. It doesn't completely prevent the issue. And it doesn't completely stop the issue if it starts. But it is quite helpful. It gives me something to kind of focus on in the moment to try and short circuit the panic issue, which is very helpful.
So a couple other questions before I take up too much of your afternoon. So it seemed like the findings on inflammation, you know, they measured C-reactive proteins, interleukin-6, and cortisol. Cortisol, of course, is more widely accepted that it does decrease with meditation. But what are the effects on anti-inflammatory from meditation? Or is that more nebulous? We don't really understand that
as much. It is a bit more nebulous. And so part of that is just kind of the challenge in doing these sorts of studies. So the question is, who's your population? Do you look at people who are very experienced meditators? Do you look at people who already have inflammatory issues and see if you get a reduction? And so I think part, and you also rely on having that study population stick with you long enough and actually practice the meditation on their own when you're not right in front of them. And so there's all sorts of confounders with this particular kind of intervention. So the data is pretty weak because a lot of those confounders in terms of meditation having a real effect, an anti-inflammatory effect. But there is, that being said, there is some data to suggest that it can suppress levels of C-reactive protein and can kind of tamp down some of those inflammatory responses. So stay tuned is what I would say on that one. The data is pretty weak right now, and I would hesitate to kind of make a conclusion.
Okay. Yeah. Well, then while we're on this weird territory, let's push even farther.
All right.
Because I've used meditation now for years, ever since I've been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and it's been very helpful with my anxiety, with my sleep, and just anger management kind of thing. But then I also noticed that it really helped me with my concentration and test taking skills. You know, so I took level one and step one or whatever, both the USMLE and COMLEX in June. And, you know, for the listeners who don't understand, that's like the big boy test, kind of like where they call it the most important test they'll ever take in medical school, the $1 million test kind of thing.
It's no pressure.
It's an 8-hour long torture. And I had to take two of them. That's a different subject. But, you know, you're competing against your peers, and your peers being medical students across the whole country, but there's even international medical students who take this test. So there's a lot on the line. And I have mixed feelings about the use of amphetamines. I understand they're appropriate for ADHD, but you know, people use them for nefarious reasons to get ahead on these tests. And I was very, very jealous. In all honesty, and because I wanted to, of course, score well, and you know, I think all of us in my generation have some elements of ADHD. So I went to my nurse practitioner, and I was like, I want this, you know, please help me. I want to do better on my school, and and concentrate better. And she was like, Logan, you're bipolar disorder, type 1, more prone to mania. You want me to give you a high potency stimulant? Like, come on.
Yeah.
Like, it's never going to happen in the world. So what I did is I actually started meditating quite a bit more. And I even meditated during exams sometimes, mm-hmm. where I would just be like, okay, I'm a little bit ahead of my time schedule kind of here. Mm-hmm. I'm going to take the next 30 seconds and just breathe. And I would do counting to make sure I didn't meditate for
right,
like 15
sure. yeah.
minutes
yeah,
in
exactly.
a row kind of thing. But it really did help out with my concentration and my test-taking skills. So can you talk about like the understanding of how meditation helps out concentration?
Yeah. So I think a lot of it goes back to the effects of meditation on the prefrontal cortex. So one of the interesting things about the development of us humans is that when we're children, we aren't born with a fully formed mm-hmm. brain, right? And so it can take our cortex.
And you could even say some medical students here are not fully.
May not have fully formed brains, but.
Well, because it's what, age 25?
Yes.
For men, especially?
Yeah. There is a delay. Yeah. And so a lot of that has to do with development of the cortex and higher order brain function, not so much the lower order stuff. And so one of the things that's been observed in children that demonstrate anxiety, that demonstrate sort of these things of behavioral inhibition, is that their prefrontal cortexes aren't as far along as their mm-hmm. peers. And that can actually persist well into adulthood, and they may never actually catch up. And so that particular part of your brain is so important for executive functions, not just being able to do tasks, but being emotionally prepared to do tasks, being able to tamp down those stressors that are trying to prevent you from concentration and focus on a particular task.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the really powerful benefits of meditation, at least that appears to show up in experienced meditators, is that it really engages and magnifies that prefrontal region of your brain.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I say magnifies, I mean it actually grows larger. There's neuronal sprouting that takes place mm-hmm. with continual practice of meditation, and stronger connections and improved ability to perform those executive functions. So what you're actually doing when you meditate is changing the structure of your brain
yeah.
In a positive way, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's not woo-woo yeah. spiritual.
And that will carry you, honestly, a lot farther than an amphetamine will.
Yes.
Amphetamines, I totally get it. For someone that doesn't have ADHD, that's using them to just kind of get up to an average level, mm-hmm. Or for someone that has mild ADHD who takes an amphetamine, it'll make you feel amazing. I mean,
yeah.
it's essentially the same thing that cocaine does, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, who wouldn't want
yeah.
that advantage? But that can come along with a number of, again, potential side effects, adverse effects down the road, including very much affecting your sleep quality,
mm-hmm.
Which in a short, discrete period of time, maybe not a big deal,
yeah.
but over a long period of time, those effects can accumulate.
Yeah.
And so those things don't tend to happen in the ADHD population because there the medication's doing what it's supposed to do. It's just sort of regulating things out. But in the population that doesn't necessarily have ADHD or may have a very mild case, yeah, you're getting the boost and you feel great.
Yeah.
But the long-term effects of that can be not so great. Whereas there don't seem to be, that's one thing that's kind of struck me as I've done reading about this is the lack of adverse effects, side effects that come along with meditation.
Yeah.
There's really not
a
downside,
yeah.
right? And so I think that's what I would say to your patient population that's like, I don't want to
yeah.
meditation. I would encourage them that, you know, hey, every drug you take has a list of side effects
yeah.
from the FDA. And that doesn't mean you don't need them.
Mm-hmm.
But this is something that you can do that's not going to cost you a dime, that has no side effects. And if it doesn't do anything, no big deal.
Yeah.
Right? You tried it, but it didn't hurt you.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that that's kind of the message. Be open to things that are outside of your comfort zone or experience level, because you never know what's gonna work for you. And why wouldn't you try something that has very little downside?
Yeah. So, I think that's a great way to put it.
Yeah.
And I also just think, I mean, I'm going to continue to work with, of course, elderly population.
Sure,
and,
yeah.
And this is going to be a constant struggle. Hopefully this episode helps, and I think
yeah.
it will. But one of my most memorable experiences of medical school and on this topic is we would teach health topics to elementary school kids, Barge Lincoln.
Oh, yeah.
And so we taught meditation one day to second graders. And so what we did is we tried to do 3 1-minute intervals, and it was kind of, you know, 7-year-olds trying to meditate. It was a nightmare.
Yeah.
But at least trying to introduce this concept was really, really fun. And what we found the best thing that worked was giving each kid a grape and saying, okay, you can't eat the grape until the minute's over.
Yeah.
But this whole minute, we want you to focus on what that grape tastes like in your mouth, the texture, the feeling, the temperature.
Yeah.
And it was great. And then it went as well as it can for 7-year-olds.
Yeah.
But the teacher said she ended up using that technique
whenever
the kids got a little crazy.
Yeah.
Because they would have snack time throughout the day. Yeah. She would play that same kind of game for like a minute, and it just kind of helped them, she thought, calm down.
Yeah.
And I think if we can introduce these meditation or mindfulness practices with little kids, they're going to be much more open to it when they truly need it with their health.
Yeah, yoga has become huge for the physical education curriculum in a lot of inner city school systems, because it not only has kind of the beneficial physical effects that yoga can have, but it does have those effects on behavior and concentration and emotion.
Yeah.
So kids that were kind of impossible before they started engaging in a daily yoga practice are much calmer and able to focus on their studies and with physical education programs too. So even starting out the day with exercise rather than jumping right into the classroom can have huge benefits for kids that were having trouble concentrating or calming down before. So, you know, even if we don't know exactly what the brain is doing, even if we don't know exactly the chemical signals that are involved or the science behind it, I think the benefit is very real.
Yeah.
And science will catch up to that eventually. But just because you can't explain something fully doesn't mean that it can't have a benefit.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you just did a wonderful promo for your colleague, Dr. Briggs Early.
Yes.
I'm interviewing her next week on nutrition, of course, but yoga as well.
Yep.
So you did a great promo.
Good, yes. I'm glad that I could give her a plug. She's my yoga instructor. She's fantastic.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Yes. Any last final words or, I don't know, anything?
No.
Go Vikings.
Go Vikings, yeah. And I would just say, you know, keep doing what you're doing with this because it is so hard for people to talk about mental health issues, and particularly people that are highly educated and looking to enter high education level fields, because you think that there's something wrong with you that's sort of your fault or you're defective compared to your peers or something like that. But that's absolutely not the case. I mean, 75% of my graduate school class was in counseling or was on some kind of anti-anxiety med.
Yeah.
And so I think the more you can let people in these professions know that it's okay to kind of talk about these things and that, you know, yes, I have a panic attack, but that doesn't mean that I'm any less capable than anyone else in this building. I think that that's a really important message to get there. So thank you for what you're doing is my final word.
Well, and thank you, because I think it's very cool. You know, all of the students here look up to you as a professor. We enjoy your lectures. You're just fantastic. You know, so CILs, for the listeners, are like these interactive sessions that we have with our teachers in front of 150 of our student colleagues.
Yeah.
And I think we can all relate to panic when you get called on.
Yep.
And, and Dr. A. Strike is asking us all these complex questions that I would typically get wrong.
Yeah.
But so we can all relate to that. And then so to look at that teacher and be like, oh, she experiences panic attacks, I think is very cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think a lot of students will really benefit from you sharing this experience.
Okay.
So thank you so much.
I'm happy to do it. Yeah.
I haven't really woken up until I've had my McDonald's breakfast deal. And I know this is true because before breakfast, I put my phone in the refrigerator and couldn't find the keys that were already in my hand.
Nothing gets the morning going like the first sip of an iced coffee. Get any size and any flavor for 99 cents until 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. McDonald's. I'm loving it.
To show you how easy it is to file a claim with Geico, we hired a nature show host.
In the native habitat of a suburban driveway, the poor victim of a broken windshield is left assessing his vehicle, utterly helpless.
Well, not true. If he's got Geico, he can file a claim online, over the phone, or with his handy mobile app.
But like a lone gazelle, he'll suddenly be left to fend for himself, awaiting his terrible fate.
Nope. Geico will assign him a designated claims team to help him out, too.
So the gazelle gets his car fixed and everything.
Wow. Nature is so cool.
Geico. Great service without all the drama.